Well, Janet, I wanted to begin by asking you if you would walk us in to your 40-part motet, kind of be our virtual guide.
Okay. The 40-part motet is a musical piece, and it's what I call a reworking of Thomas Tallis's Speminalium, which was a piece of music written in about 1573. And it's an incredible 40-part harmony piece. And when I heard it on just a two-track system, I thought immediately that, oh, wouldn't this be beautiful as 40 different separate speakers? So a lot of technical innovation afterwards by my partner, George Burrs-Miller, and I, and we recorded a choir in England, and we finally got the system played back onto 40 separate speakers. And what happens when you walk into the room, there's stands with 40 speakers set up in an oval around the space. And as you walk up to one of them, each one is a separate singer. So you really get a sense that that speaker somehow has the spirit or the ghost of this particular singer. And it really gives you the sense of, you know, the anthropomorphic sense of that that speaker is an absent person.
Does it exist? Is it showing any place right now?
Yeah, this piece is usually showing at least two different places in the world. It's always showing in Brazil. And Inhotim is the name of the foundation there, and they have a particular building where it plays all the time. But it's also in Sweden right now, and it's the National Gallery of Canada has an edition of a copy of it, and showing somewhere there too. So yeah, it's quite often showing.
Okay, so. So if we were to walk into one of these places where it's showing, you know, the National Gallery in Canada or Sweden, Brazil, pick one of them, and what do we see when we first walk up? And do we hear anything to begin with, or is there silence and then music begins?
Well, quite often when you're walking into the pieces of the motet, you start hearing the singers before you even enter the space. And so you're wondering, what is there? There's a choir in this room? And then when you come into the space, you see the oval speakers. And it's quite fascinating to watch people because they sort of walk in quickly and all of a sudden they go into slow motion. And their faces have this sense of, oh my goodness, what is this? And then they slowly walk into the center of the oval or into sort of the perimeter of the oval. And they stand there. And what it is the recording is about a 26-minute version of the musical piece, and then 3 minutes of where we left the microphones on, and you can hear the people just talking, chatting, like, oh my goodness, what the weather tonight, or somebody's coughing or horking, or, you know, and then you hear the conductor. There was actually four conductors because we had children involved, and it was quite complicated recording session. But the one main conductor's going, okay, this time we're really going to get it, we're really going to get it. And then we pause the piece at that moment, and then you hear the breath of the first choir. The whole piece is eight different choirs, you know, made up of bass, baritone, alto, tenor, and sopranos. So then you hear the choir going, the breath, and then they start with Speminalium.
And then this sound just washes over you. I mean, that's gorgeous music to begin with, but the experience must be like, you know, being in the middle of Renaissance polyphony on steroids.
For me, it was a kind of an interesting piece to do because I was very interested in having this, you know, technology, up-to-date technology playing back a 16th century piece of music. And so there is that really strange combination. But also it's the sense of that these singers are singing to God. They're singing about heaven, and the angelic combinations of voices is pretty amazing. It's when you look at the score, if you have a chance to look at the score of Speminalium, it's this huge score, and it just, you can follow the the music as it goes from one choir to another and to another. So, and that's really interested me, because then when you walk into the space, you can hear it moving around in a sculptural way. And the reason I did this is I'm very interested in ideas of sculptural sound. And I just love the feeling of sound coming from one side, then another, and crosses over you to another. And this is 24-bit sound, so it's high-quality sound, high-quality speakers. And so all those sound waves hitting your body. And as we know from, you know, neuroscience now, we don't just have neural cells in our brains. We have neural cells all throughout our bodies. So then it's just contacting you and soothing you, and it's quite an effect.
You know, I teared up just watching the video of it. I imagine people must cry.
Yeah, it's an interesting effect, because I think that if you're really, you know, you're really intense in your life and you go in, and all of a sudden you go into this piece of music and then you sit down, there's two benches sort of inside the oval, and you sit down, you see people and they do burst out crying. And they, or they just sit there, and they sit there maybe for two versions through. And I remember watching a 3-year-old conduct them, the whole choir, that which was wonderful too. So you, and people lie on the floor, and they just stare into, there might be 20 people in this space, but they're all staring into somewhere, whether it's an interior space in their minds, so that they can, or they have their eyes closed. Most people close their eyes, because when you close off the visuals, then you can concentrate more on the oral.
Oh. You know, we're talking about wonder in this hour, thinking about what it is, making the case that we need more of it in our lives. And your work in this piece in particular seems to me to be all about creating an experience of wonder. Is that something you think about consciously when you're creating a piece?
I think wonderment in our work is something that we really kind of concentrate, because we love to experience it, and we make work so that we can feel it. And so that many of our pieces have this sense of, all of a sudden you just, it's whether it's through trickery of technology or playfulness, it gives you a sense of, wow, how did they do that? Or all of a sudden you realize that you're in one space in your mind and or in the video and in physical reality, you're all in different spaces, and your mind kind of goes through this point where it can't concentrate, and so it goes into a state of wonderment, I think. And that is very important to me, because I'm almost political in my views that about art, and the art that I want to create should be transcendent. It should take people to a place that they don't have to deal with their normal lives, and that pushes them into a sort of sometimes a spiritual sense or a place, or sometimes it's a place that you're not really using your intellect. You're using more the brain in your body, or you're using the, it's hard to describe, but it has something to do with magic and play and fun and wonderment. You know, when you take a child out and they're seeing the butterfly for the first time, or you know, they see a boat and they made a floating on a river, and you know, it's very childlike sense that we want to. Of course, it also works with your intellect and that many different levels, and that's what interests us as well. But I think we definitely create work that we want to feel a certain type of wonderment.
Is there something contradictory about setting out deliberately to try to manufacture wonder or an experience of wonder? Because I think of the experience of wonder as a kind of, you know, cosmic gift. It's something that happens unexpectedly, unpredictably.
Well, I think there's so many different definitions of wonder, right? Because if it's the wonder that you get when you watch a magician, and even a magician that does, like, my brother-in-law's a bit of a magician, and he does this trick where he puts elastics on your fingers, and he put elastics on my fingers and then did it. And there's no way I could figure out how he did it. And like, that's wonderment. But it's also like when you see, I was just in the Prado Museum in Madrid, and looking at the Paradise of Earthly Delights by Hieronymus Bosch, And people were all standing around just going, how did someone create this world? Like, how did they ever think of this? And how did, you know? So I think artists deliberately do that because we enjoy it. And I don't think wonderment, it comes naturally in the physical world, of course, but I think it's quite fine if it's manufactured.
Well, we should talk about some of your other pieces. You've done a series of audio walks, and these were actually the things that you first became very well known internationally for designing these. I read that the first one you did was inspired by a walk you took in a graveyard.
The process, yes, you're right, was inspired by that because I was in the Banff Center for the Arts and doing a residency there. And part of my process is I just, you know, I do a lot of stuff that never makes it to the actual gallery or to the art world, but it's like method acting for me. So I'm recording on a little tape recorder, walking around, recording the names off the grave sites. I'm just out for a walk and thinking, you know, this would be interesting. And then I press rewind by mistake. So then I got to find where I am because this is back when the time of, I think it was a DAT recorder. So the time of tape. So then I press play and I hear my voice. I have a headset on. So I hear my voice describing what's in front of me. And I hear the sound of the birds and I lift my headphone and said, no, they're not real birds, they're recorded birds. And so this whole, it was just like one of these synchronistic happenings, serendipitous, I guess you'd call it, where I was amazed. Like, this is really a neat experience. I'm not sure why it's interesting, but this is really a kind of a very cool experience that following a voice as it walks along, describing what's in front of it, and then hearing sounds from the past. So then I started working with binaural audio, which is basically a dummy head that has two microphones in the ear. And when you replay the sound you recorded on that onto a set of headphones, then you feel like the sound is almost three-dimensional. It places it because it uses the dummy head as a filter to bounce off the sound. You know, coming from one direction, it takes longer to get to your left ear if it's coming from the right, and et cetera.
So the recording, then, you're hearing the sound come at you from two directions, the way we really hear sound through our ears.
Yes, and the ears are designed mainly for placement, you know, so we know where the bear is going to come, right? We know that scraping sound in the rock is coming from our right rear, so we can run the other way. And that's, we use the idea of the quality of the ear as placement for things, and so we can play with that. And we call it, often in our work, we're playing with these things. And so the audio walks were very much about that. I'd take people on a little walk and take them here. And it wasn't important really where you went, but I'd take them into environments. Say the first one was in the forest at Banff Center, and you heard the train in the distance. But that was recorded the night before while I was in the hotel room or my residency room, recording outside the window. And then I edited it so that it sounded like it was there when you were walking. And
so you're kind of layering different realities.
Oh, yes. Yeah. Sometimes there's like 30 different realities layered. And what I don't know why it's fascinating to me, but I love the idea that it's kind of a literal translation of the complexity of time. Mm. How I can't record in the future, but I can record in the past. And you can layer 20 different timelines together into one timeline with audio, and it's seamless. So you can walk down a street in London in the East End where I did an audio walk, and you can hear the sirens from the Blitz. And then it's layered with, you know, a helicopter going over that was a sound effect I got from, you know, say the Vietnam War. Or you can hear gunfire from somewhere. You can hear people walking, or a car alarm went off when I was there, so I recorded that. And so you have all these time periods together.
But
and to me...
Sorry, go ahead.
That's a sculptural sense. I don't know why it's interesting sculpturally for me, but it fascinates me that I see sound in these different places and it brings it together. I don't know. I love it.
But that London piece, the other thing you add in is there's kind of a little story. Actually, there's more than one. There's kind of a story within a story within a story, something about a mystery, maybe a woman, or maybe we're the woman. What's going on?
Yes, and quite often I think a lot of the pieces are like those little Russian or Chinese dolls where you take open one and then you hear something underneath. And I try to, that's kind of a good metaphor for how I use the sound in that particular piece, because the story, there's always kind of a bit of a narrative behind some of the audio walks. And the narrative behind this is that this woman is invisible and lost in London. She's walking around, but she's listening to a tape recording she did herself from years ago. And this tape recording, she sends to a detective and says, you need to find this woman. And so the you hear the detective voice on as he's trying to search out this woman, but you also hear the character, the woman, which is my voice, giving you instructions as you move around, and she's listening to her past voice. So I don't know if that all sounds completely convoluted, but...
Well, having listened to some of it, it doesn't, because... So then the experience is, you know, if I'm listening to this, I'm standing, I think it begins in a library, I'm standing in a library, mm-hmm. I'm wearing the headphones, and your voice is telling me what to do. And I start doing some of the things you tell me, mm-hmm. but then you start embroidering, you know, new stories come up, things happen. And after a while, honestly, I was just sitting in my office listening to this, and I got this strange feeling that I wasn't entirely sure where I was.
Yeah. I think people get very much in a trance when they do the pieces. And it's interesting that people want to follow it and they want to be in the right place. They want, it's almost like our training in life is to do things properly, right? Follow the instructions properly. And the reason I try to have them at the right place at the right time is that things sync up. Like I'll say, there's a lime green car parked across the street. And I knew that was a painter, Chris Ophelia's apartment right there. And I knew he has a lime green car, and it was quite often there. So then when people were doing it, Chris told me later, he'd looked out the window and he'd see people stop, and just the look on their face was like, oh my God, how'd that car be there? And she knows it's there, and this is the past. So there's those kinds of levels of what happens, that they see banana peels when I'm talking about there's a banana peel on the pavement. Because I've searched out the area, and I know that area that people are rushing off to work in the city, the financial district, and they need some breakfast, so they grab a banana and they throw their peel. So there were a lot of banana peels. So if I said that they'd either find it 5 seconds before or 2 minutes later, that they'd find a banana peel. So I'm manufacturing these kinds of synchronicities, but at the same time, it is one other layer. And then there's a narrative layer that just kind of keeps them going. But then I see them as how you put poetry together. You put images of sound. Like at one point, they hear this crazy kind of band that's walking past them with kazoos. You know, you just imagine you're in a Fellini movie all of a sudden or something like that. You know, it's
there. So you really, it kind of blurs the line between what's real and what's imaginary or virtual. I think I've read that you call this a third reality.
Yeah, because there is the reality you're walking in. If you didn't have the headphones on, which is the physical reality we know as physical, I mean, hypothesizes physical. And then there's the technical tape-recorded reality, and they really do mix. And I say they create this third reality that is the imaginative with the real.
I read there was a New York Times reviewer who took one of your walks and said it took him most of an evening to feel back in the present. Do people have that experience? They get really disoriented?
Yes, and the audio walks that had a strange effect. We noticed that people would say that they saw more visually when they listened to the audio walks. They'd really see the textures of the street. They'd really see things and whatever. It almost accentuated their visuals.
Now, why do you think that is?
Well, I read one study after I was doing walks for a while that said that when you describe something that you see in front of you, you see that thing more. So maybe something to do with it. But I think it's because when you have recorded sound, it's louder than real sound. And your ears can't filter it the same. It's like having to have a hearing aid. Everything is amplified. So I think that somehow makes all your senses get more tense. So that's my theory. But then with the video walks we added, we started doing them in like around 2000. And they're really fun for us to do because, and they're all collaborations with George because he used to be in filmmaking and editing and things like that. But we give people a video screen. It used to be a video camera and they would look on the screen, but now we give them eye touches. And what's on the eye touch is that you're still listening to three-dimensional binaural audio, but you're looking at a scene that is pre-recorded on the same site that you are. We just finished one for Castle for the Documenta, and it was in the train station in Castle. And people would be walking along. And on the video, you might see, say, a ballerina dancing or, you know, some set-up acted scene. But in people's periphery, they see the real reality. So they see people rushing back and forth for trains. And on the video, you see people rushing back and forth the train. But all the architecture is the same.
So the video screen becomes like a little portal into another world, and yet it's right there in the present.
Yeah, and what people do is they hold it up so that they're lining up. They love to line up the visuals on the screen with what they see as the architecture in the real space. And then what happens afterwards, we found, which gets back to your question, is that afterwards we found that people really went into a trance. And in the investigations through doing these, we read that one of the trance techniques is to have people focus near and far, near and far. And so that's what people do in a video walk. And so sometimes when they come out of it, we suggest don't drive right away, you know, because it's... They're just sort of standing there, and they're not. Their brain has gone into this alpha mode or something. I don't know what type of brain mode it is, but it takes them usually about 10 minutes to get out of it.
Wow, you just answered the next question I was going to ask you, which is, do you think there's something valuable or beneficial about that experience of feeling unmoored, you know, detached from the present?
Did I answer that? I'm not
sure. Well, you suggested it's a trance state. Your brain waves change. I mean, maybe there's something deeply relaxing or good for us about the experience.
That's true because, I mean, all the latest information says that meditation is good for you. But I think at the same time, your senses are heightened, but you're in a trance state. So there's, say, one section in the piece where we have them coming down a corridor, and then you hear someone coming, walking down behind you. And so that you have the same kind of like shivers on your neck for someone coming behind you in a very intimate little space. But yeah, I'm going to say they're good for you.
I'm curious about, you know, out of all of the media you can use, and you trained as a visual artist first, you use sound. Why is that? I mean, do you feel like sound takes us places, offers us something that the other senses don't?
Well, definitely. And I can say that working in sound more than visuals. But for me, when I started working with sound, it just went, I just felt like, yes, it finally hit me in my chest. It felt just right. And it was able to express the ideas of working with memory that I wanted to express, working with, you can still work with visuals. You create the visuals in the people's brains. And for me, it's a medium that can go into people's minds in a way that is non-intellectual. And then it hits them in a more emotional way. And rather than when you're walking through a museum and you're using your visuals mainly to look at the works on the wall.
So there's an old famous line, I don't remember who said it, but radio is like television, but with better pictures.
Yeah, I think it's like literature, too. You know, when you've read the book and then you see the movie and the movie is very disappointing because you had all these images in your mind.
Mm-hmm.
I think that the way we use sound quite often has a real connection with literature.
The other thing that I keep thinking listening to you talk about your work is how much playfulness there is in here. I mean, it reminds me of the way children fall into making believe so easily and so seamlessly. You know, they're playing and then suddenly they're making up something, fantasizing, and then they move back to the real world. It's that seamless back and forth between the imaginary and the real that characterizes children's playfulness. And it seems to me that that's that's a strong characteristic of your work too.
I think you're right about that. And George and I quite often have the attitude when we're in the studio that we don't have, say, an idea and we just go build it. We might have an idea and then we sort of approach it, but we're very playful about our approach. And then quite often we discover things through sort of what we call playing in the studio that we never would have discovered if we'd just gone through, say, doing a drawing of it, taking that to a manufacturer, you know, having it built, you know, there it is. And I find that the play and creativity, like you talked about with children, it's just so essential to the way we make work. And I think because we enjoy it. We enjoy playful works, too. We enjoy, if you don't enjoy it, there's no point doing it. Like there's a lot of hard work in art making, too. You know, there's tons of sitting in front of the computer. Like one piece we did, Murder of Crows, that has 98 speakers in it. And there was 700 and some audio tracks mixed down to 98 speakers and controlling the sounds as they move around the space. There's a lot of that knit and gritty, you know, slag work that goes into it. But at one point in the process, it is kind of the same kind of thing as play. It's letting your intuitive part of your brain just go full rein and have some fun.
I imagine viewers or people who experience your installations and your walks must respond very differently. And of course, your work is... it has been seen in many different countries. You've got installations up in Sweden and Brazil and Canada, all over the place. Do you find that people respond differently? You know, some people are readier to play.
Well, I definitely do. It's interesting you say that because we've had a lot of success in Germany. And Germans have a huge sense of curiosity. I think curiosity in artists, in the viewers, in the audience, is very important. And I don't know if that's because they start talking about art early on in the life of, you know, in their educational system, or if because they don't really believe in schooling before their kids are seven, so they believe play is very essential. And I think Canada's just getting sidetracked with this whole concept of pushing kids academically before they're seven. I think that's just silly. It destroys the creative urge and destroys a sense of playfulness. But we found that some pieces don't go over in America because there's such a short attention span. And I don't know. I think Canadians are a bit better. But, you know, pop culture is so like boom, 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 and giving you all the answers. Like the movies now... I hardly even watch movies anymore unless they're by really intelligent directors because they're so often so dumb. You know, it's the dumbing down effect. Like, okay, I get it. You don't need to tell me 10 times. And so the people, when they go to museums, sometimes want the answer right away or they want something right away. They don't want to wait 20 minutes for a piece to unfold itself and then have to think about it. Whereas a lot more, I think in Europe, people are much more open to that.
Well, maybe you'll change things when we get to see more of your pieces here.
And I shouldn't say that generally because, you know, we're in we've had lots of work in America and the Americas, like North America and South America, and it's all been pretty successful. But I do notice when we have shows and there's sort of New Yorkers coming in, they really don't have the same attention span because, you know, they're texting while they're listening to 40 Part Motet or something.
Oh, well, I think that's a challenge to the magician in you. You're just going to have to try harder to stun us.
Well, that's part of it. And then the different pieces are different because Motet, you know, there's much more history, say, in France and Italy of religious music or in England, you know, where Thomas Tallis, he's a British composer. So that people are used to the dialogue, they understand the whole concept of this type of music and how, you know, they take music in school and you know, there's much more a sense of classical. So I think they understand it more in Catholic countries too.
Thank you so much for talking, Janet. This was great.
Oh, you're welcome.